All right, let's get off the reporting and let's start it from here. That's the man I want to speak to. That I'm going to speak very frankly, and I make it a little rough sometimes. I hope, as always, I will remain within the bounds of not matters of common decency, but tact. Let us dispose of various problems first of all, and I must explain. Well, let's just explain. I'm sick to death of my good pals of business. The woods is full of them. Everybody is. Physicists and mathematicians, mathematicians today have everything.
I answer, he is not a physicist. That was a wrong introduction on my part.
I'm not, this is not against your guest last night, but I'm speaking now. I'm off the Major case, I'm off Dr. Davidson, I'm off the Flatwoods case, and everything. Let's get into this whole business.
You're on, Ivan.
I'm on the subject of UFOs and a lot more besides. And let me start at the beginning. We are a technological culture in this country and in the Western world, and the whole world is becoming that way. Now, our technology is at the present moment founded on what is called physics, not in the physical sciences, but physics. And the physicists are most honored amongst the scientists today. At least I prefer mathematicians on top to the kind of theory, and then it's physicists and then down to the chemists. That's all of the biologists sort of tagging along. Now, I would just like to point out that, I don't know if you know this, many people in this country don't realize when I have vulnerable accents, you realize that I was born and brought up on the other side. I discovered to my dumbfounded amazement only a few years ago that what we call popularly in this country science, not science at all, it's technology, gadgeteering, partisanship for the most part. What we call philosophy in this country is what's called pure science in the rest of the world. And what the rest of the world calls philosophy, we call metaphysics in this country. All right? Well, let's get on to it straight. Now, about 99% of physicists, and I'm not saying anything against them, are gadgeteers. They're not scientists at all. Merely by meta-semantics, it only takes one fermi to devise. Think out the principles of an atom bomb. It takes 100,000 people to put one together. And we live in an age when it's the people who put bombs together that matter. We almost worship them. And I think to the enormous credit of the physicists, who underpaid as they are, overworked as they are, have not yet founded an orthodoxy and or a hierarchy, nor are they bullying people around. They're trying to do a hard job. There are scientists. Amongst chemists, about 25% are probably real scientists. Do you know what the definition of science is? We look it up even in Webster. It is the exploration or investigation of the unknown, not of the known. Technology, from technos, you look that up in the Greek dictionary, you'll find out that it actually comes down to the further elaboration of, or understanding of, or knowledge of the known, or technos. Technoia, I think you can just name it anyhow. Now, many are really working in the field of pure science. In other words, it's almost, it starts with imagination, just like science fiction does, following which comes a hypothesis, out of which may develop a theory, after which you test the theory, and if it works out, you finally have practice. And the chemists are examining real things. Do you realize that the only thing that doesn't exist, the only thing that we know for sure is absolutely true, that's mathematics. Mathematics, we can't say that word tonight. But there's no such thing as mathematics in nature outside of an intelligent human-type mind. It doesn't exist. If you add five apples to two apples, three apples to two apples, you don't get five apples. There's a lot of apples lying on the ground. Mathematics is a very peculiar business, but it is the only thing that's actually true and can actually, in every case, be proved right or wrong, despite that horrible little figure, which means possibility, which is now crept in, and infinity. But it's a past science. It's the only thing that doesn't really exist. Physics is the next one down. Do you know a certain physicist, who will not mention his name, who's one of the people who helped us put the atom bomb together, pointed out to me not so very long ago that when they let off the first experimental atom bomb at Alamogordo, we knew of the existence of 14 less particles in the nucleus than we know now. So really, they were sitting around with something they didn't know very much about. So you have a lot of theoreticians, or a few theoreticians, people who put this stuff together, and they're not bad with technologists. Then you come down Biology is dealing with facts, which are studying from ourselves on up and on down. And they, the majority of them still have to be scientists. There's a lot of biological technology going on. But on the whole, the biologist has to be a little bit more scientific, shall we say, about it. I'm not being snide. I'm simply trying to put the thing, it's a matter of semantics and nothing else. But a lot of people don't understand it. They think of sending radio sets and putting atom bombs together is science. It's not. Gadgeteering of a very advanced order. Army wants a bigger bang and the Russians have done. You get 100,000 people together, you dig the things out of the ground, you put them together in a certain kind of way, and you get your big bang. But the families of this world and the people who think of the theory and develop the theory are exploring the unknown. Now, there's been some little scientific respect shown to this whole subject of what I call ufology. And I think it's about time that one of the sciences could find time or space or place to allow this strange subject to be taken in. The meteorologists don't want it. They're far too busy. They're concerned with things in our sky, so see, which they have to know about. The astronomers don't want any part of it. Anyhow, they can't see half these things as reported because they're either too far away or too close up. And they don't fit into that scheme of things. The physicists don't want them at all because they're part of physics. The chemists are only interested in the chemistry of the sky as a whole. And so on down the line. The biologists, at least of all, people have simply, well, this is obviously not to do with us. And so they even put psychologists and psychiatrists. They say, well, bad liquor, mental hallucination, deflated navy blimps. I don't know why. I thought, oh, that went flying on the flying, the sea monster thing. That's one of the great explanations of sea monsters. Deflated navy blimps. The poor navy must have been getting rid of blimps at the rate of about 400 a year for the last 100 years. But all these kind of, they're really very silly, let's face it. Here there have been what their old Charles Fort used to call OSM, objects being floating. I think it's a much nicer connotation to UFOs, unidentified flying objects. Objects being floating, gently or otherwise, in the sky. I would point out that nowadays they're always dashing about in the sky, whereas in Fort's early days they seem to be just floating there rather gently. But these types of things have been seen throughout history. And don't think that it all falls in newspaper reports. Ford started picking up reports for his book. He took an archive date of 1800. A couple of other gentlemen you mentioned before, Jessup and so on, have dug out reports in Wilkinson. I don't remember if Wilkinson or Wilkinson, who's his name, but anyhow, everybody who's interested in this thing will know who I'm talking about. It's gone way back to early Chinese literature. But quite a bunch of the Bible, you know. Not only the flying wheel in the sky, but Isaiah being taken up in the fiery chariot. People wanted it in those days. They weren't frightened of what somebody was going to tell them, that you're lying, you're a hoaxer, all the kind. What they thought, they said, and they got in the press, so then it went available. The ancient Egyptians have certain very peculiar things they stated, but much more important than that. And I would ask you, and any of you listeners, just go to the New York Public Library. Get a hold of the proceedings of the Royal Society of London, starting with its inception in the late 1700s, and going on up to about 1865. Just ruffle through the pages of those proceedings. You will find story after story reported to the Royal Society of London by members of the Royal Society of all kinds of dreary things being seen in the sky. As I said before, about the only shape that never seems to have once been reported yet is that of a saucer. Lenses, things that look like the bottom of lamps, lozenge-shaped jobs, some quite so square things, cylinders, things that look like kites, cigar-shaped objects, lights of all kinds, objects with lights on them, and so on. I really don't think that anybody, except for possibly gentlemen of the press, and I can't think why they're so against it, any longer really laugh at the fact of there being a lot of things buzzing about in the sky, or having been seen in the sky. I mean, to turn around and say it's all nonsense, it's just absurd. On the 13th of October, I stood with 10,000 people out on that road watching this alleged balloon. My eyesight's fine, of course, I didn't have any field glasses. It looked awful funny.
this report in Scientific Journal, and the Royal Society of London, a very spirited-minded organization, and all this has, I think, been credited with being there. And here they have them in their official journal. You can find them in several meteorological journals, which are three to four. He's not all newspaper clippings, you know. He gives these little references in an awfully funny way, but the references are there. And I've spent days, maybe cut out four copies of Charles Fort, and card index and cross-index every single statement of the nature of those things which I'm particularly interested in on a card index. And I did a lot of sitting in the library after I'd been ill for a time. You're asking for these different journals, not newspapers, and seeing that the things are really in there, they're there, all right. Well, actually, it's funny enough, where the actual pages have been torn out of the journals right in the public library. We had to send for a second set and a third set before we could find the proper pagination, and there was the story. But it all seems to have come to an end in the Royal Society, for instance, about 1870. They had a wonderful president called Sir David Brewster, who seemed to have had an extremely open mind in the better sense of that word. And he allowed these things to be published. But about that time, you see, science, or rather, technology, was getting going, becoming patternized. And you couldn't have things outside the textbook. Dr. Seth was this in. I mean, after all, the theories, geological theories, the door has been laid down. You couldn't suddenly ask for another 2 million years dandy between the Oligocene and the Eocene, for instance. It would upset the whole picture. And until somebody could actually come up and show you a huge block of rock that went in there, the thing is ignored. In other words, they said, look, let's concentrate on what has to be done to get on with technology. And that's scientific thinking forever. So we've got to do all the sciences, and that seems to work. We'll get rid of the rest. It's a purely historical gesture, as it were. Now, with great cause, let me explain why. I'm sort of pontificating too much. There is an easy reason for it. Science has a methodology. In addition to being the investigation of the unknown, I doubt if you'll ever get a thing like the occult received into the body of pure science, because I'm not interested in the occult. I'm interested in everything. Incidentally, I might throw in that one thing my short life has taught me, that a lot of things are improbable, so I don't think anything is impossible. Now, the occult, I don't think, will be included in science because it is not open to measurement, which means, in its widest sense, that if a man says, I have invented a vaccine to polio, not only has that vaccine got to prevent polio, but somebody else, using his published account of how he prepared that vaccine, has got to be able to do it in another time and place and come up with the same result. If somebody says, I saw a flying disc over Oregon at 9:10 on the 11th. There's not much you can do about it, because it's not a scientific statement insofar that you can't reproduce the disc at any other place at the same time. That's a very crude way of putting it. I'm stretching the rubber band as far as I can to try and make my point. Science is precise. You've got to be able to weigh and measure the object. At least you've got to be able to reproduce it on the mark. Dr. J.B. Ryan ran into that great difficulty when he was working on EST. You seemed to come on and go off without any kind of regularity. You couldn't definitely just say to the guy, look, I've got the following result. And on paper statistically, with a gentleman sitting in front of me, and with a girl in a room, four rooms away, and then get up and walk out and another investigator take over, it's going to get just mixed up, just to come on and go off. It's going to be very difficult in those borderline investigations. However, ufology, I believe, is a very much more practical thing than that. I believe it would eventually, or could eventually be subject to a proper analysis and probably a measurement in time if people would take the thing seriously. I don't know whether any of the air forces, particularly the Swedes and the Peruvians, I continue to stress, because those are the two great areas in the world where these things have become so very, very numerous. I know that the British have grabbed a lot of strange substances that have fallen out of the sky, but there's a very complete report of it, and I think they are also pretty interested. But first day, once again, we give credit to our air force for having come out and done something about it. I don't think that it's enough to be successful for covering up. Anything is the other way, they've done a wonderful job in trying to find out something and putting out these super reports. So we'll cover those details. we have overlooked one major fact in trying to be what I'd like to call scientific about it, or at least objective and logical about it. Everybody's dashing about with preconceived ideas, and all of them that I've heard on your program recently have been ideas stemming from physics with a little bit of chemistry thrown in, a great deal of cloak and dagger stuff, and a certain amount of publishing business, and all the rest of it. Not one single person has thought, has really used their mind to say, now, in the overall, what could these things be? Now, you think I'm going to jump right off this subject to America? Say something rather funny. You take me outside to the Carteret here. We're not too far away from the turnpike. That'd be all this soil between here and there, despite all the oil in the minute. You take me up any cubic yard of soil, I take soil, anything else for that matter, any way you like. Give it to me to take to a lab, and give me a little bit of money, pay some technicians, to examine that cubic yard of soil. I said a yard, a cubic yard, yard by yard by yard. I think I'm right in saying, and phenologists and various other virologists and so on may correct me, I would say there are 10,000 different kinds of life forms in that one block of soil. The time you're taking the bacteria, and the little worms, the little insects, and the eggs, and the funguses, and all the rest of it. Well, perhaps I'm exaggerating, I don't know, I may be taking a touch of that. But there are thousands of different kinds of life forms living right in that one little bit of soil. Now, the different life forms of the surface of this earth are absolutely incredible. There are about a million species of living animals which have Latin names already. The entomologists, the bug hunters, the insect people, insects alone, mind you, I'm not talking of crustaceans or the spider group, the arachnids or the centipedes, which are all the jointed legged animals, but the insects alone are half that number, at 500,000. And the entomologists assure us that we've only got about one-ninth of those yet to be discovered on the surface of this earth. That's insects alone. There are 25,000 species of known species of beetles in the British Isles alone. It may astonish you to know that there are 822 species and subspecies of mammals indigenous to North America, the United States, of which over half are rats in the wide sense, rats and mice. Now, this business of UFOs, the airline thinks it's their flying saucers, is this or that. They are probably of such innumerable different kinds and different origins that it will take an enormous science to do anything about it, simply to catalog these two things. And I absolutely refuse to give any opinion. And here's my coming up to say that they are, I certainly will definitely say they're not all one thing. They're not all two things. They're probably hundreds. Now, I heard a rather fast one on you, John. We were talking about some interesting things of different nature coming out here tonight. I've got the finest set of UFO photographs, I'm sure, that you've ever seen right here. With them, I hope to make a point that I have been working up to. You may have guessed what it is. If you haven't, don't give it away to your listeners. I'm going to show you these photographs in a certain order. They are set up on cards. And we have to do the video as well as the audio right here. They're set up on cards with a piece of little window cut in the cover. And I want to show you them to you one at a time, and if you have any violent comments, make them. But I'll turn you off if I think you're going the wrong way. It's a demonstrating point. May I pass it to Sylvia first, and you pass them on to John. If you want to make any comments, that is, of course, an ordinary... I would say almost with the Adamski style, if you little round things underneath.
Well, you must look at it too, that these are what you would call reliable accounts of fine objects.
No, I can say that. I said they're reliable, already published photographs, which I imagine the Air Force must have seen. They may have done, they may not have had the money to get on for it. Here is one of those jobs which has these porto or on side.
I think I know what it is, but I can't say anything.
All right. What do you think that is? Is there some particular...
Well, they look like some sort of Paper. You can
see what they really are. They are pages taken out of Dr. Harvey's book on animal life. And they are all animals or vegetables which luminesce at night, with chemiluminescence. The two that you're looking at are the very small animals which are found in the sea of the jellyfish nature. They have in every way the appearance of many of the descriptions of different types of UFOs. Now, I'm not saying that the photographs of UFOs that are being presented by such gentlemen as Mr. Adamski are photographs of this nature. We have got in front of us two types, or two measures, by which photographs could be faked. I refuse at this point to say whether I think the photographs have been printed or otherwise are faked or are not. That's not a whole subject which I'd like to get on, if I may. I hope I've got some of your millions of listeners to a point, of course, and I hope that it is also logical. I pointed out that life on the surface of our planet is incredibly, on the surface of our planet and in the waters of our planet, is incredibly complex. And the numbers of forms that just simply go on, there are millions of life forms. But leaving out all this photograph business for a moment, but I have shown you things here which I'm sure you've never seen before. They are called radiolaria, infusoria, globigerina. There's huge groups of single-celled animals which are found in every drop of water practically in the world. Diatoms. Go into any biology class and look at a drop of its water and you'll see cylinders, lenticels, even porpoises. Triangular things, yes, little saucer-like jars, little plate-like jars. Take some of your own blood and have a look at the plate that's in it. They're little blind saucers. It is still the red blood cell. In any big medium, it is preferable for an animal to adopt the most perfect of all forms, is the globular form, I presume. For purposes of locomotion or for sitting on the bottom or going up and down, they become compressed out of the top to bottom or from side to side. Then comes the question of tensile stress of the structure. Gelatinous ones just go out like an amoeba. If they want to retain some kind of form, they will probably become hexagonal, triangular, dodecahedrons, tetrahedrons, or various geometric shapes. And these small animals that drift about, the plankton as it's known, which we may all have to feed on one day, which whales feed on, which most fishes feed on, is made up of millions of these little diatoms and things, and they're the most wonderful little shapes, because they float suspended in the water. And they take so long to sink, they never get anywhere to fit them in. Their whole life cycle is passed through in the sinking of a few feet, perhaps. Sometimes a year when the sea goes green, when lakes suddenly go sort of reddish, that is when you have what's called a flush of maybe bacteria or infusoria or one of these small protozoa type animals, or bacteria in some cases, sort of luminous bacteria. You ever opened your refrigerator and found a fish that you've got in there for the next day glowing happily in the dark? I have. It's an alarming experience. That is the type of bacteria which is lodged in the fish's scales. Those individual little bacteria, so small, you cannot see it with the naked eye. You have to get quite a powerful microscope to see each individual little one. They put out continuous cone of light throughout their tiny little lives, which, in proportion to their size, is about 400 times that of the power it gives in New York City. Nature is a very, very wonderful thing. Now, I'm coming finally to my point. Why I brought these things up was to point out that the biologists have not yet had a say in this UFO business. Now, I must give credit to a Swedish gentleman who I've never met. I don't know who he is or where he is. His name is spelled Zoe, which I understand is the Polish way of saying Joe. Wasilko, Wasilko, hyphen Zarecki, Serecki. I have talked about this myself a couple of times on the air, but very tangentially. This gentleman has developed a theory, and I give full credit to him for bringing it to my attention. I've been working on it for a year, and when I've been working on it, I've been thinking of aspects of it and putting them down in those logical sequences. You know that animals feed on matter. on the other hand, feed half on matter and half on energy. They take substances in liquid form out of the soil through their roots, and they combine sunlight by the use of chlorophyll and the energy of the sunlight, combining with chemicals to build up their food substances from which they build their bodies. So we have life forms on the surface of this earth which are living on matter entirely, or half matter and half energy. Now, nothing is impossible in nature, and it's highly probable that there could be life forms. I'm not talking about animals, or viruses, or plants, but another type, a fourth type of life form, which feeds exclusively on energy. Where is energy of certain kinds to be obtained in the purest form? Well, of course, all matter is energy, basically, but it's kind of locked up energy, isn't it? We're finding that out now with our fusion and our fission bombs. Takes an awful lot of power to get the locked up energy out of matter, or put it back in and gather it up and stick it in to make the matter stick together. Where is a lot of free energy of certain kinds available? At the outer limit of our atmosphere, where such energy is pouring upon us from the sun, for instance, and from many other sources that we find now from radio astronomy, this further gentleman's initial suggestion was that there may be life forms living up there of a high tenuous nature, which are enclosed in a bladder type thing, which for some reason, and I think he has good reason for saying this, and I will not try and go into the technical carriage too much, probably contains a certain amount of certain quota of silicon as its principal element. The inside may be sort of a gaseous mixture or quasi gelatinous, but most of it's stable. That they will adopt certain forms, particularly the globular, the lenticular, i.e. the saucer, the oblate spheroid, I think it's called, the cylindrical, perhaps when they're breeding, they will adopt, like I have seen myself under the microscope, and there are photographs of the ordinary splitting of a cell in mitosis. Have a look at it sometime. The chromosomes, how they bunch themselves together, and they put out some strings between the male and the female one, we should say, or the X and Y. And they put out some strings, and all the chromosomes bunch together, and then they join, and then they split in the middle the other way, you know, so we get sort of the generations that pass down to each cell. There are the small sea animals, which come together at a certain time, and when I say sea animals, these minute eaters that I'm showing you here, the amoeba does it. Two amoeba will sort of flow together, and insist, they make into sort of a bigger one, and then they'll lie resting a bit, and then the skin bursts, and out come lots of little ones. There are other kinds where two come together, that are sort of plate-like, and they seem to throw out under the microscope little spaces between them that makes like a little cylinder, X being at one end and Y at the other, and then they rest in that stage of time, and then out of them come little pairs of little things which don't look like either the cylinder or the two parental objects. A better description of that I have never heard than given by Mr. Michel in the cases reported from all over the south of France. A sort of cylinder appearing in the sky for some hours, and little pairs of things coming out of it dancing around its tail, but whenever two of them touched, there was a blinding flash, and a lot of this stuff called angel hair came tumbling down. We'll get to that in a minute. His theory, and very much my theory, is that not all UFOs, but that there may be a very large class of life forms living on the outer edge of our atmosphere, which are hardly life forms. In other words, they're entirely for natural phenomenon. There could be such things. Now, everybody says, well, that's all very well, but wait a minute, why do we see them? Well, I am not good at optics. But you know perfectly well that most of our telescopes are trained on things outside our atmosphere. Most of our meteorologists are spending their eyes on things inside our atmosphere. We are working like mad now, so is the Air Force, and everybody is, to find out what goes on at the edge of our atmosphere. But nobody's going to turn around and tell me that things haven't been seen floating about in the sky. They have. And they are just a type of form which, due to the natural environment, a natural object which is not an inanimate object, and is neither an animal nor a plant nor a virus, but is, in other words, a life form, might take up
happen. Then people say, well, wait, come, some of these things of enormous size have been reported. I'll take that up for 1 second. Then they say, oh, they traveled this fast. Well, I knew the figures either. I should have made some notes before I came. I'm sorry, John, but I will give them to you, and if you want them read on the air, I can either read them or I can send you a note, and you can read them yourself. If you take the density of water as a medium, and the pressure of water at the bottom of the ocean, and at the top of the ocean, and you compare it with the density of air at ocean level, and then on up through to our outer atmosphere, and you extrapolate, as it were, from what figures we have in water into the air. I don't know if I'm making myself clear. An animal of such and such a size, traveling in the medium known as water, can develop a certain amount of energy only within its muscles. The most efficient of all is probably the blue whale, which is just one great huge hunk of muscle, actually. And it can go at a tremendous speed. Think of seeing a 113-foot long jumping clean out of the water. It can go at a certain speed. In the atmosphere, the lower atmosphere, things can travel much faster. Birds, for instance. As the atmosphere rarefies and goes up, the things can travel much faster still. And by pure extrapolation, according to Mr. Wessler Zaleski, and he said himself, he said, we've got to get somebody to go into the actual details of these figures, but about it. You can multiply the speed of something in water by 700, I think, and you will get the speed at which an object of the same size or comparable size can travel in the ionosphere. Also, that of size. The harder you're pushed on from around, the better it is to be small. I mean, the looser the medium around you is, the bigger you can be without upsetting things. Enormous sizes reported to some UFOs are not at all without size of bounds of a life form living in a rarefied atmosphere feeding exclusively on the radiant energy.
Now, may I ask you just a question occasionally, following your thoughts now, is it conceivable that as this life, if this life form exists, as it gets closer and closer to the light source, which on Earth our plant life uses, it could conceivably move it at the speed of light?
That's a lovely thought. I haven't gone that far. That's not one that anybody's brought up before. That I would have to ask some state-of-minded physicist like Dr. Higginbotham or somebody who does have a slight interest in the biological aspects of these things. I may make a note of that and forget it for a moment so I can remember it for myself. It's a great thought. But I would, in the meantime, like to try and find myself in the bounds of possibility as well as possibility, everything's possible, probability of the surface of our planet and its atmospheric envelope as we know it at the present day. We're finding out a lot of things about it which we didn't know before. You know, the old idea was the further you went out into space, the colder and colder you got. But as you know now, there's a great layer up there that's for your heart. Please let me stress and stress and stress again that I do not say that all UFOs could be or must be or may be or are to be explained by this theory put forward by this Polish fellow originally. On the other hand, I'm going to give you some I hope, real shockers anent this particular theory. I can't have the time or the facilities to put over the theory without visual aids and an awful lot of discussion and explaining myself, and I'm sure all of you are itching to get at my throat and say, well, what about this and what about that? I'm only trying to give you the conjecture which goes behind this theory, and I believe now me, it is quite a theory, but quite a lot to it. There are certain aspects of it which have made me more deeply interested in this. In this aspect of UFOs than any other, but have made me work more on it because I am a trained biologist and my whole life is with animals, with life forms of one kind and another. I would just like to point out a number of different ways in which UFOs, as described by the poor, long-suffering, bleeding public who've seen these things throughout the ages and have coughed at, take heart, dear soul, because the number of things that some of your UFOs, you report as doing, are the natural habits of life forms, and particularly of animals, as a matter of fact. I live with animals, I know. Don't think that animals, we're the only animals in the universe that have intelligence. If you've ever watched a about his next move. It's not all instinctive, Ned. If anybody can tell me the difference between instinct and reason, they better get on the air right sharp and prove it. Now, take some of the things that these creatures do. How come even to their sudden stops to turn? Any animal, any life form which could travel at 15,000 miles an hour. And some of these things have been alleged to do just that. People, 90,000 people say, well, this is absolutely ridiculous. By extrapolation of what animals can do in a liquid medium, or burrowing under the earth, to start with moles and things, how slow do they get along? So moles go rather rapid, as a matter of fact, anyhow, things burrowing around under the earth take a longer time. They have to shove their way through. They have to use a lot of muscular energy. Animals in water can travel faster and more freely. Animals in air can travel faster still. If you get up into practically nowhere, they can travel at enormous speeds. And that wonderful point that Sylvia brought up, which I'm going to think about very deeply, is it not possible that the closer they get to the source of their energy, the faster they may be able to go? Of course, I've got some nasty ones coming in a minute when we come to another aspect of ufology. That is the whole question of teleportation and the possibility of transgressing the speed of light, which, as Einstein said, that before he died, is only a theoretical point, just the same as the speed of sound is a relative point. I remember when I was a kid, I was told that no aeroplane would ever surpass the sound barrier because air became virtually spot solid at that point, and it'd be like driving an aeroplane into a brick wall. Of course, all the silly people who were telling me had all forgotten that bullets and things had been going through it for a very long time. It'd be very well looked at in fact. Unless this business of running into a brick wall, incidentally, will bring me back to what I'm talking about UFOs. You know the ordinary cockchafer or June bug, the big beetle which comes bobbling along? It is made of stuff, it's a natural plastic, it's exoskeleton, the hard shell of the skin. But it is, it's very nice to be. It's a something of a millimeter in thickness only. And yet, one of those beetles can drive straight into a brick wall at up to 50 miles an hour, bang into the wall, fall down on the ground, get up and walk away. I'd like to see some of our beetles travel to the speed of 50 miles an hour. There is a lady, you say, they can travel at enormous speeds, but the surface flies. There's a certain surface fly. You know that when you go into a pine wood and you see this thing looks like a yellow jacket that's hovering in the air and suddenly it's somewhere else, sort of egg-beater-style helicopter thing. It was alleged by one scientist, and of course he was immediately slopped on the head for having said so, but I believe that he wasn't too far off from the work of other people, was alleged to have been able to travel 800 miles an hour. Well, that's before anybody broke the sound barrier, and there was an uproar, especially over the top of the Mexican mountains. I don't know, I bring it up more as a joke then, because he did say it in scientific print, and he got warm. That was the end of him for a time, but they have found that animals do travel flying. Animals dig the insects, the smaller they are, the faster they can get along, and the beetle is a bit faster in addition to that. But I'm thinking the other aspect of it, flying into a brick wall would make it only 40 or 30. You try driving your car into a brick wall at 40 miles an hour. I'd like to see some steel produced, which has the tensile strength of the material of which the outside shell of a beetle is made, considering how thin it is. We've got a long way to go. Anyhow, back to these UFOs, those ones which might possibly be a life form. The enormous speeds must be intolerable. Anything that can go at that enormous speed obviously does not suffer from too many G's, as it were, in acceleration. Also, if they can go so fast, they can stop so fast. And if they stop so fast, they can go off at another angle. In other words, they don't make a right angle turn. They come to a dead stop and go off in another direction. That is possible. But I don't think that this type really do that very often. I think that belongs to another category of UFOs. We deal principally with this kind. I'll get to both of them first. Just a few other points. I have shown you photographs of luminous animals in the sea, a fungus, bacteria, fish. Almost every form of life known has luminous members. I found a luminous beetle in a cave in Trinidad. I immediately got smothered for that, but all along the side of it, another scientist found light organs. There are luminous
steady. There is one bird, the young of this particular bird in Australia, really. Little birds open their mouths to be fed, and sometimes the inside of the mouth is luminous, not because they are luminous, but that I have luminous bacteria have lodged in there. The theory is that the mother can find them more easily in the dark. There are sponges which are luminous. There are jellyfish, there are squid. Now, squid are particularly interesting. They are cigar-shaped. And they have, like, port lights all around the side. And they are vivid. Some of the deep-sea squid that have been brought up, for instance, the Indian Ocean, have four different colored rows of port lights along the side. If you like, ask us to look through the Maurice photographs and see some of those squid. There's a fish called the Photoblepharon, which I caught when I was quite a youngster, in the Banda Sea, off the coast of the Moluccas. And that was off the coast of Celebi. They look rather sort of rather dirty looking little fish, rather sort of tall looking stuff. They're like a porgy. And under the eyes, which of course fish's eyes don't have any eyelids, it has a sort of like another eye, it's really a pocket, a sort of kidney-shaped pocket underneath each eye, with a movable lid, as it were. And in this pocket, in some extraordinary way, this fish manages invariably to gather an enormous amount of luminous bacteria, which just live in there like a sort of parasite, live happily there, glowing away all the time. And when the fish wants to see his food on the bottom, he simply opens his little shutters and he gets two little headlights pointing down onto the ground. It's the most amazing thing to see. We had some in a bucket, and it was all dark. Suddenly two little headlights came on so he could see the ground in front of him. Now, I come back to the luminous squid, for instance, that have these port lights set along the side. You'll see others there, that wonderful stop and go bug, which has red lights for going, for stopping, and green lights for going, presumably. It really does have red and green lights on it. It lives in, all the time inside a dark log in the Brazilian jungle. Now, a lot of these UFOs have been reported to have these brilliant port lights along the side, some of which are circular, some of which are lodging shaped, some of which are square. And the pilots have described the lights as being so darn intense it looks like a mercury flare inside, the Wicked Cage, for instance. So the idea of light forms having self-luminosity or carrying their own light is not in any way beyond the bounds of possibility. In fact, it's highly probable. Now, if these things get their food, their energy, and were evolved to live in rarefied atmosphere, or even perhaps just that maybe right outside the atmosphere, actually in interstellar space, there may be things drifting about. After all, if they can feed exclusively on energy, and we know there's matter all through space now in a very tenuous form, they might be able to pick up enough matter to make a sort of sphere, you see, or whatever other shape, cigar or lens. And it is interesting that many, in fact, nearly all cases report that the outsides of these animals look more as like aluminum. Both fish have a sort of silvery look, don't they?
Very true.
They might stink like the devil if they came down too low and got drowned in our atmosphere. They would drown probably in our atmosphere. This is a non-technical way of putting it. If they come down too far. On the other hand, another aspect of this fellow theory is expressed in the life force. These things have always been seen in the sky. They sometimes drift down. Maybe they get sick and go down, like when whales go. When squids get sick, they come up. But they have been appearing, if you take a map, and map the appearance of UFOs, as Dr. Davidson said last night, they're always turning up in radio beams. Also, they occur much more frequently over atomic energy plants, over large cities, exactly, over all the places where we are broadcasting, telecasting, putting out masses and masses of electromagnetic energy, which didn't in the olden days used to be put out of these places. These things get their food from above. If they can begin to get a certain food from below, they, being life forms, come down and do a bit of investigating. Maybe they can come down with this very strong radio beam and bathe in the radio beam, pick up a certain amount of electrical energy from that, but they need very little, being so tenuous.
Would they, pardon me, Ivan, would they affect our radar?
Naturally, they would. They're solid objects. They may not be very solid, but they are. They're not hallucinations. They're things. And of course, they would affect
enemy signaling to each other. What happened, what really blew it up, was this in the end. One of these green, glowing objects landed on a road in Curacao when 500 British troops were marching from Wilhelmina Port up to take over the oil fields after the fall of Holland, and landed in front of the officer on the road one of these things. And I don't know if the officer, being good British, had said charge or forward men. But anyhow, they chased this thing, and it played tag with them. It would bounce along and disappear into the gutter, run along to the culvert, duck through and come out the other side, and sort of wait for them, and then run away in front of them. And it finally just went up the sky and disappeared. And from then on, the Admiralty decided that these things, most of the green lights, are probably natural phenomena. Indeed, they are. Now, the Foo Fighters, the activity of that thing, the activity of the Foo Fighters, and much of the behavior of many UFOs is exactly that of an animal. They are inquisitive. And when people say they seem to be intelligently controlled, they are, because all animals are intelligent in a matter of degree. Even a bumbling opossum, and anything that moves at high speed, has probably got to have some kind of intelligence. Of course, is a bad word, because maybe they'll be able to find it. But in other words, they are intelligently directed from within, do you get me? And they come down and play tag with the aeroplane. What they are, this smell of metal, they're giving out energy all over, come bounce along and pick up a little food while we're on the way. These funny great bubbling things that come up, you know, all the things that come up from the bottom of the sea, we're amazed. Whoa, look at this interior thing called a crater. It's now known as Archituchus, a squid, which can grow with its tentacles up to over 30 foot long. For years and years it was laughed at, the first sea monster. Now everybody in the museum has pieces of them. In fact, they use them as the bait for codfishes out of the Grand Banks, have done all the way through. But one Professor Verrill took the trouble to actually go up there and catch one. But we're amazed at some of the things that come up from the bottom of the sea, from these deep sea fish. These things are probably just as amazed as giving them a sort of a morbid connotation. But they're looking for food like everything else. And they're not going to run into a plane. They can move much faster than the plane. They can play around with it, dodge away in front of it. A lot of these other things that come down low, like that fourth Coastmaster, who was reported to have got seriously burnt by one of these things in the Florida swamp, do you remember?
Yes, that's right.
Well, now, take a life form feeding on energy. It must be able to store energy. Electric eels can store, oh my goodness, what a lot of electricity can store in storage batteries. These things are little powerhouses of their own. Coming out here, fuzzing around the Florida swamp, maybe got lost or tired or sunk to the bottom or got in the wrong convection current or something. And he's floating down there, feeling probably quite uncomfortable because there's tremendous air pressure around him, which he's not used to. And then making this part of human, which is trying to explain animal intelligence and behavior, rather. Behavior is a better word. And up comes a human being, and out of all innocence goes up and gets too close or even touches it, and whammo! He gets a terrific electric shock. I'm using the word electricity to, again, oversimplify, because the different types of electromagnetic waves there are, the range is enormous. And so there may be one kind of speed in this wave range, another one here. There may be thousands and hundreds, perhaps millions of different kinds of these creatures. And their behavior, I say, is definitely that of a life form. And I could go on indefinitely giving you such cases, such correlations between reports of UFOs and animal behavior. So now let me cut that out and say I would not attempt to put any percentage on those which I think might be life forms. I try to be objective and particularly scientific. I'm interested, in other words, in the exploration, investigation of the unknown by the use of personal imagination, secondly by hypotheses. We need facts. I don't know if anybody's got a UFO yet. I very much doubt if this animal type or this life form type could be got at. Because apparently, when they get down to our atmosphere, they dissolve. They proceed to dissolve. And sometimes when they clash amongst themselves, there seems to be a discharge of some kind, and this angel pair comes down. You know the case of the policeman in Philadelphia? He saw it land on the pavement. A great shower, and the widow picked it up. I can bring you four or five witnesses from up in our Warren County who saw a similar thing, and they went and picked this stuff off the trees. you know the old saying that it's migrating spiders? And they put out a web and then they go blowing on it. What's most of the spider's web? You can tell spiders when put on the microscope. It's a string with a little drop of oil on it. This nut, they picked it up, and as they put it on their hand, it becomes jelly. And then it doesn't appear to dissolve right inside you. Other people, I believe, the Donald Kehoe has some locked up in a bottle or had some at one time. And when it was let out, it has no structure that we can find. I don't know whether he's had that analyzed. I think two or three people have tried to do it, but whenever you can get it to a lab, it just dissolves inside you. It goes away. In other words, it dissolves our atmosphere. This Lapwood case is very interesting because we've suddenly discovered that those things there, which look much more like machines, I must admit, come over the mountains and hit an updraft. There have been big forest fires, Monsanto chemical, all those collieries, and the atmosphere at the crest of the mountains where they came over was highly charged with carbonaceous matter. And they seem to be unable to cope with carbonaceous matter in a gaseous form of particles. They may have clogged their breathing vents, relay machines, or animal life forms. And they all went out of gear at the same time. One managed to land, two got away because they were on outside edge. Don't forget, it was number one and number six that did so. Keep on going. And the other two crashed, and one blew up in the air, or it sort of came apart in the air, came unstuck. And the ashes that fell out that Mrs. Williams saw was nothing else but the beginning of angel's hair. Or, as Charles Fort says, there have been rains of substance which looks exactly like blood. There have been rains of ashes. There have been rains which would show certain carbonaceous content. But you had one of these things a mile and a half long. It might be so tenuous that you could, without the energy stored in it, you could drive a plane through it. And you'd only come out with a sticky mass all over you. But still, there's an enormous amount of material in there in a very tenuous form. Supposing it dies. Suppose it dies sometimes and they run out of energy or something goes wrong with their mechanism. I mean, when I'm speaking of biology, biological mechanism, when it runs out, they die, and what are you left with? A amount of carbon, silicon, and so on. And the end product, as it falls very rapidly through the increasingly dense atmosphere, will burn up just like a meteor. And all you get is ashes, of course, hence your rains of carbonaceous matter. Your rains of blood may be of a similar nature. Maybe the heavy parts may have a certain amount of liquid in them, and so on and so forth in your own color. Let us, for pure theoretical purposes, let us say that 80% of UFO reports are dealing with life forms. All that they are, get them out of the way. There is no, we cut another whole group, then off the possibility of another whole group. There's no reason whatsoever why there should not be other intelligence, other forms of life in the universe of the level of our intelligence or above it. And nobody can deny possibility that intelligence of our level or higher, right up to the almost godlike, need not be contained in a body such as we have, made of hydrogen and carbon principally, which is highly suitable to our planet, but on other planets, not going necessarily going around our sun, going around other suns. And in the, how many suns are there in our galaxy of the size of our sun? I think it's 400 million or something, or 400,000 million or something like that, in our galaxy alone. And according to the theories of Kuiper of Chicago and Weizsäcker of Germany, planets are a natural concomitant of the formation of a sun. When the sun starts with a whirling legendary orbit, as it contracts, the heavy matter flies out like the centrifuge, and the light matter goes to the middle and makes the sun. And automatically, by a very complicated thing of whirls, you'll eventually gather up all the heavy matter and make the planet. And there will always be a set of planets going around every sun. Well, every sun is the same size as ours, probably got a set of the same number of planets, so about the same average size, according to Bose's law, anyhow. Throw that into the benefit of purely astronomers. And the third planet out will probably be very equivalent to Earth. There is such a thing in nature, known to biologists as parallel evolution, you know. One animal living on one continent can, over millions of years, due to the same things that it has to do, develop into looking almost exactly like a completely different animal on another continent. They're not related in any way, genetically, but they come to look almost identical. That's called parallel evolution. There's no reason why even human-like looking mammals couldn't be developed on a planet going around another sun of the same size as ours. The sun is being made of the same material as we know through spectroscopic analysis and so on. Therefore, there's no reason why there should not be life forms with intelligences such as ours. anyone who can build machines, who would want to build machines, and who might go flying in them. We cannot discredit the possibility that there could be, in other words, man, and I've used man in quotes, manned UFOs, which are machines, structures, guided by an intelligence either riding in that machine or controlling it robotically from a distance from a mothership. There is no reason why that category could also not be included.